Let the record reflect that today is Wednesday, April 12th, 2023. And today we'll hear a presentation from the Office of Legislative Auditor on Southwest Light Rail Transit Report. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record. You know, take your time anytime you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Catherine Tyson, and I'm OLA's Director of Special Reviews. Thanks for inviting OLA to come today to share information about the reports that we've recently completed on the Southwest Light Rail Transit Project, or Southwest LRT. There we go. Before we dig into the details of our work, I'd like to run through what work we've completed as well as what's still forthcoming. In October 2021, we released a memorandum on Southwest project costs and management that details a dispute between the Metropolitan Council and the project's design contractor, AECOM Technical Services. In September 2022, we issued a special review that describes the timing and cost overruns and project delays. I'll be covering the key points from that special review today. And in March 2023, we published an evaluation report on the Metropolitan Council's decision-making during construction. My colleague, David Kirchner, will talk about the key findings and recommendations from that report today. I also want to note that OLA is currently working on two additional reports on the Southwest LRT project. In the coming months, we expect to issue a second program evaluation report, this time on the council's oversight of contractors. And then later in this year, we expect to issue a financial audit on the Southwest Light Rail project. So let's first take a look at the information covered in OLA's September special review. Once it's complete, the Southwest LRT line will connect downtown Minneapolis to the suburban communities of St. Louis Park, Hopkins, Minnetonka, and Eden Prairie. The project includes the construction of 16 new transit stations, a 14.5-mile light rail track, 6 pedestrian tunnels, 2 light rail tunnels, and 27 light rail vehicles. The Metropolitan Council is the agency responsible for overseeing the design, construction, and eventual operation of the light rail line. In our special review, we identified 3 key drivers of cost increases and project delays over the life of the project. All 3 issues relate to the proximity of Southwest Light Rail to the existing freight rail lines. As you can see on the screen, about half of the 14.5-mile light rail line is located next to active freight rail lines. As I talk about the key drivers of cost increases and project delays, you may also want to consult the map that we have on page 19 of the light blue special review report, which shows a portion of the shared freight rail and light rail alignment in St. Louis Park and Minneapolis. In 2011, the Federal Transit Administration approved the Metropolitan Council's application to pursue funding for Southwest LRT through a federal grant program. In that year, the council projected that the cost of the project would be $1.25 billion. But since 2011, the cost of the project has more than doubled. In December of 2022, the council had estimated that the total cost of the project would be approximately $2.77 billion. Mr. Kirchner will explain in a few minutes that this dollar amount is still an estimate of the total cost of the project. I'll also note here that the federal government and Hennepin County have provided the majority of funding for Southwest LRT. The Metropolitan Council's timeline for completing the Southwest LRT project has extended 9 years beyond the end date initially anticipated when the council became the agency responsible for overseeing the design and construction of the project. In 2011, the Metropolitan Council estimated that it would open the line in 2018, and by 2022, that opening date moved to 2027. As the chart on the screen depicts, delays have occurred in both the design and construction phases of the project. The design phase is the period of time it took for the council's design contractors to turn broad concepts for tracks and stations into detailed designs. This was also the time in which the council finalized the scope of the project, completed required environmental impact analyses, and obtained the consent of the municipalities along the line. The construction phase is what it sounds like, the time that the council's construction contractors will be building the lines and the systems that power the vehicles. After the Southwest LRT line has been constructed and tested, the Metropolitan Council will begin service and operate the line. I want to emphasize before I move on that delays themselves have increased the cost of the Southwest LRT project. The timeline for completing the line directly affects several elements of the Metropolitan Council's budget, or estimates of the total cost, rather. For example, the council's budget estimates include costs to purchase materials, which have increased over time. The budget also includes costs to retain consultants and construction contractors who design, build, and inspect the light rail line. And their compensation is based in part on the duration of their work. In our special review, we highlighted a number of factors that have increased the cost of Southwest LRT and delayed the completion of the project. Three key factors that I'll talk about today are the uncertainty of the final location of freight rail along the project's alignment. Second, the light rail tunnel currently being built in Minneapolis's Kenilworth corridor, and the need for a concrete wall to be built between freight rail and light rail traffic in Minneapolis. Early plans for Southwest LRT assumed that an existing freight rail line would be moved to make way for light rail along portions of the alignment in Minneapolis and St. Louis Park. These plans were recommended by the Hennepin County Regional Railroad Authority, or HCRA, and adopted by the Metropolitan Council's governing body in 2010 as the locally preferred alternative. A locally preferred alternative is a mode of transportation, such as a bus or a commuter train or light rail, as well as the route that's selected by a local or regional authority for a future transit project. When the council applied to the Federal Transit Administration to begin the process to pursue federal funding for Southwest Light Rail, it assumed that freight rail would be relocated, that it would be moved out of the Kenilworth corridor, and that would be handled as a separate project from the light rail project. However, when the Federal Transit Administration granted Southwest LRT entry into the federal grant process, it said that freight rail had to be moved, or that relocation project had to be moved within the scope of the light rail project. Despite the importance of freight rail relocation to Southwest LRT project's planned schedule and budget, the question of whether to relocate freight rail or co-locate freight rail and light rail in St. Louis Park and Minneapolis remained an unresolved issue into the early 2010s. In 2014, after extensive study and input from elected officials and the public, the council determined that relocation of the freight rail line was not going to work, and instead decided to build the light rail line next to the existing freight rail line in Minneapolis and St. Louis Park. In summary, the time needed to study the co-location route and feasible relocation alternatives, gather input, revise the designs, complete required environmental reviews, and secure the municipalities along the line, added time and perhaps years onto the schedule even before we get to construction. The second key driver of cost increase and project delays is the tunnel being built in Kenilworth Corridor. Kenilworth Corridor is a narrow strip of land located between Cedar Lake, Lake of the Isles, and Bede-Makaska in Minneapolis. To preserve an existing pedestrian and bike trail and an at-grade freight rail line without removing existing housing, The council elected in 2014 to build a shallow light rail tunnel within Minneapolis's Kenilworth corridor. The picture on the screen shows kind of what that looks like, and it's a cross section. However, there were many issues with construction, and particularly with the method originally designed to construct the tunnel. An unanticipated soil settlement during the initial tunnel construction required the council to choose an alternative construction method where the tunnel will be built close to a condominium building. In September 2021, the council officially approved a change to the construction method for part of the tunnel. Not only was this change costly, this new construction method alone cost $30 million, but the change also delayed the completion of the project. The new construction method requires different crews, equipment, and it also prompted the council and its contractor, its construction contractor, to replan how it would build the tunnel. Mr. Kirchner will be providing a lot more detail about this tunnel in a few minutes. The third key driver pertains to the need for a concrete wall to be built between freight rail and light rail traffic along a portion of the alignment in Minneapolis. This wall is referred to as the corridor protection barrier. In negotiations with the BNSF Railroad Company to use its right-of-way for Southwest LRT, the Metropolitan Council agreed to build a 1 mile concrete wall to separate freight rail and light rail tracks. The addition of this wall to the project, which was formally approved in April of 2021, cost about $83 million in construction costs. And the council used money from the project's contingency fund to pay for this change. And this change order alone had a significant effect on the contingency fund. As you can see on the screen, from the beginning of construction in 2019 to April 2021, Southwest Light Rail contingency funds decreased gradually. However, the addition of the corridor protection barrier in April of 2021 dramatically decreased the project's contingency funds. For some context, at the beginning of construction, the contingency fund balance was about $204 million, so this single change alone represents about 40% of the initial amount in the contingency fund. In the months that followed this change order, additional changes reduced the contingency funds further, and that left the project insufficiently funded in the summer of 2021. In August of 2021, Hennepin County provided an additional $200 million to the Metropolitan Council in order to shore up the project's contingency fund. I'm now going to pass the presentation over to Mr. Kirchner to speak about the program evaluation's findings and recommendations.
Thank you, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is David Kirchner. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I was the project manager for our program evaluation on Metropolitan Council's decision making. And to pick up where Mr. Tyson left off, that kind of is sort of the background part of the presentation that covers kind of the area up to the construction process. And what I'm going to be talking about today is particularly what happened during the construction phase of the project. Our key findings in this program evaluation were that by January 22, so at the very kind of end of that chart that you just saw, the Metropolitan Council had obligated itself to spend more than the funds that were committed to the project. It really couldn't go forward or go backward. Secondly, we believe that there is a mismatch between the entities that fund light rail construction in Minnesota and the entities that are responsible for constructing it. And I'll go more into that in a little bit. Third, the council's addition of work after the competitive bidding process was one of the key reasons that led to increased costs and delays. Fourth, the Metropolitan Council did not hold its civil construction contractor as accountable for project scheduling as we believe they could have. Fifth, there were a number of pre-construction analyses before they started building the Kenilworth Tunnel, but those pre-construction analyses did not predict the significant difficulties that the project eventually encountered. And last, the council has not been fully transparent about the increasing costs and delays on this project as time has moved forward. So I want to start off by talking a little bit more about the increase in project costs, and I'm going to start off from this chart that Ms. Tyson showed, but I'm going to really talk about specifically the far right part of that chart, that is the increases during the construction phase of the project. At the time that construction began, the budget for this project had already grown, and as was at that point, about $2 billion even, $2.003 billion. And as Ms. Tyson pointed out, in August 2021, the council went to Hennepin County and said that, well, we don't have enough money, we're going to need an additional amount of money, and the Hennepin County added $200 million at that point. In January 2022, as I believe many of you know, the council announced that that increased amount of funding still would not be enough to finish the project, and that it would eventually need $450 to $550 million additionally in order to complete Southwest Light Rail. And so the estimated budget that we show here on the screen grew at that point to $2.65 to $2.75 billion. Since that time, there has been some additional money that has come in from the Hennepin County and from Metropolitan Council, managing to transfer some federal money from other purposes over to the Southwest Light Rail project. So the current official budget for the project is $2.384 billion, but that is not sufficient to cover the amount that is needed to finish the project. The current amount that the council estimates is $2.767 billion, and that's based upon information the council provided to us in August 2022. This increase, a 38% increase just during the construction phase, is pretty unusual when compared to light rail projects elsewhere in the country. We have a chart here on the screen that shows a large number of other light rail projects, and you'll notice that only a very few have had really significant cost increases during the construction phase. So we're in a small and rather uncomfortable kind of category there of light rail projects with these kind of significant cost increases. Now, we got to those cost increases because of decisions made by the Metropolitan Council. And those decisions were made starting in 2020. And in fact, the Metropolitan Council continued throughout 2020 and 2021 to make decisions that would lead to the funding that they had available being used up without having a clear idea of where that additional money was going to be coming from. By 2022, when the council announced that it would need $450 to $550 million additional dollars to finish the project, it had already obligated itself to spend some of that money. In fact, the council at that point did not have enough money to go in any direction. It did not have enough money to finish the project, nor did it have enough money to halt the project or to pause the project, because that would have required additional expenses as well, which the council didn't have in hand. This set of decisions, we think, raises fundamental concerns about the accountability of how decision-making is made with regard to light rail construction projects in Minnesota, because the Metropolitan Council had very little of its own money invested in the project. As Ms. Tyson said, the majority of this money has been coming from Hennepin County and from the federal government. Thus, the council decisions to make these changes, the council decisions to increase the amount of money that would be needed for this project in order for it to be completed, were essentially being made with other people's money. Other people were going to have to come forward and provide, other entities were going to have to come forward and provide the money that the Met Council needed. And that is in part by design, that the way in which we have set up light rail construction in Minnesota, there is a mismatch between the entities that fund the construction of those projects and the entities that make decisions. And we think that that is a fundamental problem. So we make a recommendation to the legislature that the legislature create a framework where the entity that is leading light rail construction have a significant amount of its own money at stake in the project. And so the entity that is making the decisions is penalized. It feels the pain, if you like, when a project goes over budget, and they're rewarded if they can bring it in under budget, because then they have extra money that they can then use on something else. The way that this currently works, that's not the case. The Metropolitan Council is making the decisions, and other people are paying. Now, the implementation of this recommendation is complicated, and the reason for that is because all other options for constructing light rail have problems, both positives and negatives, really. MnDOT could certainly also construct light rail projects. It built the Hiawatha line, and it is used to building large construction projects, but MnDOT would probably have to assemble money from a variety of different sources, just like the Metropolitan Council has. MnDOT cannot just simply, for example, take trunk highway funding and put it toward a cost overrun on a light rail project, because that money is constitutionally dedicated for trunk highway purposes. Counties would meet our criteria. Certainly a lot of their money is at stake, but counties don't have the same experience building a light rail project, a massive light rail project, the way that MnDOT and the Metropolitan Council do. Also, transit runs across county boundaries, and so you may have inter-county coordination issues. Lastly, the Metropolitan Council could continue to be the light rail construction entity. Our suggestion is that if that is the case, the legislature should provide the Metropolitan Council with some sort of ongoing funding source so that it has some of its own money at stake when it is doing making these decisions. But we also hearken back to our report of over a decade ago, our 2011 report on the governance of transit in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, where we expressed serious concerns about the accountability of Metropolitan Council to its local stakeholders and suggested that there ought to be other approaches to choosing the members of the Metropolitan Council. So we would encourage the legislature to look at those recommendations as well if it were going to provide the Metropolitan Council with additional funding sources, so there would be additional accountability that would be tied to that additional funding. I want to move now and talk about delays on the project, the delays that have happened during the construction phase. One of the reasons for those delays goes all the way back to the bidding for this project, when the project was first bid out to civil construction contractor. At that point, the Metropolitan Council did not have complete specifications for all of the things that were going to be included in the project going forward. It knew at the time that it put the bids out that it was going to add significant extra work. Specifically, it was going to add the corridor protection barrier that Ms. Tyson already talked about, and that it was going to add the Eden Prairie Town Center Station back into the project, which had been taken out of the project for cost reasons at an earlier point. And then Eden Prairie was able to get some additional funding through the federal government, and then it was brought back in. However, incorporating these elements into the project after the project had already been bid and the construction contractor had moved forward with how it was going to construct the project without these elements led to significant cost increases and delays when these elements were added back in. Additionally, because they were added late, that meant that those elements were not part of the competitive bidding process. That is, Metropolitan Council built these large project elements. As Ms. Tyson said, the wall is around $83 million. The Eden Prairie Town Center Station was, I believe, $11-12 million without a competitive bidding process. The Metropolitan Council has claimed that had it waited longer to do the bidding so that it could have included those elements into the project, that the project would have cost still more than it has ended up costing. We are not fully persuaded by that argument, not to say that it's wrong, but that I don't think we have any way of knowing whether or not it's right. We think it is unknowable whether or not the cost would have been greater had they delayed bidding longer and included those into the project. But it's certainly the case that those items were not competitively bid, and we don't think that any public entity in Minnesota would ordinarily do a $83 million project without competitive bidding. But that happened in this case because it was an add-on to a much larger project, a much larger bidding process. And so it was treated as a change as opposed to a separate project. So we do have a recommendation the Metropolitan Council make greater efforts to avoid introducing major project changes once the competitive bidding process concludes. I want to now talk about project schedules. The Metropolitan Council, we feel, did not do as strong a job as it could have at holding the civil construction contractor accountable for meeting the Metropolitan Council's requirements with regard to project schedules. The contractor submitted numerous project schedules to the Metropolitan Council over a period of months, and the Metropolitan Council rejected practically all of those schedules. But then it did not take kind of a whole lot of additional actions other than just simply rejecting the schedules and telling the contractor, you know, do better. We think that the council had more leverage available to it in the contract that it chose to use. And instead, the Metropolitan Council just continued to move forward with constructing the project, even though there was not a fully agreed upon schedule in place that met the Metropolitan Council's requirements. We think that that is something that they should do better at in the future on future projects. And I will note that this is a recommendation that is very similar to a recommendation made by MnDOT in a peer review that they did of this project in December 2022. I'm going to now shift to talking about the tunnel. As I noted at the beginning when I went through the key findings, the Metropolitan Council's pre-construction analyses that they did before the tunnel was built, they did a whole bunch of pre-construction analyses, and they looked at a lot of things beforehand about what might crop up. And we have looked at those fairly carefully, and the Metropolitan Council did not, in fact, know that the soil settlement issues would occur. Their pre-construction engineering indicated that those soil concerns or that soil would not be a concern on this project. And so we think it's important to put that on the record, that that was not information that they had available to them. However, it is certainly true that the tunnel was a significant high risk, high complexity piece of this project. And so we do have a recommendation that the council might consider additional external reviews for elements of a large project like this that are particularly high risk or high cost project elements. And I will once again note that that is also an element of the MnDOT peer review that was done in December 2022. They made a similar recommendation. Lastly, I want to talk about project transparency. We don't believe that the Metropolitan Council has been fully transparent about the costs and delays of this project. The problems that cropped up on this project cropped up fairly early. Construction began in 2019, and already by 2020, there were serious concerns about the tunnel. There were serious concerns about how disruptive it would be to add that corridor protection barrier to the project. By October of 2020, the civil construction contractor was already projecting a 25-month delay due to just the tunnel issues. And as Ms. Tyson pointed out, when you have that large of a delay, you also are going to have a large increase in costs as well, because delay drives costs. Now, the council didn't necessarily agree with that 25-month figure, but it was clear already in 2020 that there was going to be a significant delay to the project, and it was going to be costly. In January 2021, the council did announce that there was a potential delay to the project that might occur, and they weren't sure they were going to hit that 2023 date that they had initially projected. At that point, we think they already knew that there was going to be significant delays and there were going to be significant cost increases. But they were not really clear about that until they stated that they needed the additional money from Hennepin County in August 2021, and then finally coming forward in January 22, a year after this first announcement, to say that they were going to need an additional $450 to $550 million because of the tunnel, because of the barrier, because of Eden Prairie Town Center Station, because of all of the delays that adding those pieces caused. They could have been more transparent about that earlier, in our opinion. We will note that they did talk to their principal funders about these ongoing delays and costs. So Hennepin County and the Federal Transit Administration did have some information about this ahead of time, but they were not as transparent to the public and the legislature as we think that they could have been. In the law that the legislature passed, that both houses of the legislature passed, that asked us to do these evaluations that we're presenting to you, there was also another piece of that law that stated that the Metropolitan Council ought to notify the legislature about forthcoming costs and delays on Southwest Light Rail. We think that's a good law, and in fact, we suggest that that law should be expanded to cover all light rail projects, not just Southwest Light Rail. That it be put into statute as opposed to in session law. We also think that that law could be tightened a little bit. The way in which it's currently written, we think, leaves some loopholes that the legislature might be interested in closing. And I'd be happy to talk about that in greater detail if members are interested. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm done with my presentation, and either one of us would be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Before we go to questions, is there anyone else who would like to testify regarding the OLA report on Southwest Light Rail? Please come forward to the testifiers table. Welcome to the table, Mr. Chair. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Charlie Zelli. I'm chair of the Metropolitan Council, and I'm joined by Nick Thompson, who's the deputy general manager of capital projects for Metro Transit. I certainly appreciate the OLA's report, and I know that they will be willing to answer additional questions, as will we, but I'll give you my initial statement, and I appreciate the opportunity to respond both to their report, but also be open to any questions or comments from the committee. First off, I really do appreciate the OLA staff and the really complicated audit process because this is a complicated and a difficult project. And I know that that review and the history comes with these series of reports. I also appreciate and have really checked to ensure that Met Council can be as responsive as possible to their questions. I've heard some figures of like the as many as 80,000 pages of material all told has been shared. So that it is really an exhaustive study, and I appreciate the staff of both staff to be able to kind of handle and to work through so many complicated questions. The important thing, I think, from Met Council looking at this project in reflecting on the many lessons learned, both from the experience of the project, from MnDOT's peer review, from the OLA report itself, is there's just no question that this large cost increases during the construction of this the Minnesota's largest public works project has been compounded by a number of different elements. And I think David Kirshner has outlined it well, but if I had to put an even more firmer point on it, underestimating the risk of freight rail co-location in a narrow passageway with uncertain soil conditions is just something that really affected this project, both for the schedule and then with an increased schedule, the additional costs. And of course, hindsight is 2020. I think we've had a lot of learnings as you approach projects, and some of those learnings have already been deployed in some of the currently being planned and actually some under construction transit projects that we are undertaking today. One of the most kind of poignant policy changes from Met Council has been the transitway advancement policy that we put forward and passed to the Met Council at the end of last year. That really is a way to explicitly have a process where we can strengthen projects by clarifying the risk, the roles, and the responsibilities as we face these projects going forward. You know, in retrospect, understanding and of course, we appreciate and actually agree with some of the findings of matching funding to accountability, but actually understanding fully what risks there are and to ensure that you have plans and then additional contingencies to meet the unexpected. From our Metro Council perspective, we think that the report does minimize the amount of transparency that we've had in this project. I don't mean just the well-documented public meetings and hearings and frequent meetings with our funding partners, but also just the very specific FTA-driven process for transparent accountability. There's no question that in 2021, we were aware that of issues, which is when we actually began the negotiation with the contractor over schedule and a very thorough resequencing of the whole project. At that point, and I've learned this in my transportation experience, is you don't lay out as fact something you don't know. We did not know the level of delays, the level of cost, until we really worked through those issues with the contractor, which in the process itself mitigated a considerable additional costs and delays. And so simply put, the resequencing negotiation, which didn't necessarily follow the contract, it was actually renegotiating the contract in a way with outside experts, with national construction authorities, that helped us actually get a better number, a number that we've now represented and has been not changed since January of 2022, and one that we know we have now a way to hold the contractor and the systems contractors accountable. This is a process that MnDOT in its peer review fully supported and actually appreciated the process that we went through in order to put this, to get our handle on this project and to deliver it to completion. There's no question that without the commitment of our funding partners, and I'll put federal and the local funding partners, to continue the project every step of the way was something we followed. And just to clarify, there was never a contractual obligation for funds more than we had. That's really important to understand. There was never an obligation, a contractual or commitment for funds to anyone that we didn't actually have contingency and funding availability. What we didn't have is enough funds identified to complete the entire project. That is true. Neither did we have it at the gold mine until yesterday when the FFGA came through with the federal government. Transit is different than MnDOT highway projects. Highway projects, you have to identify the full funding until you start the project. Transit starts projects without the full funding identified and then has an expectation and a way to work that out. That has been a standard practice. Now, that's not one that we are necessarily happy with Southwest Light Rail, but we have the full commitment from our funding partners to keep the project going, because that was ultimately going to save taxpayers' funds. It's going to keep the project going forward, and it was in the best interests of all stakeholders. So I will just leave it at that. I would love to, and am available to answer any additional questions. Nick Thompson is an expert, but we'll stand back and know if others want to testify, we're available for additional questions. We do know that these significant projects have significant benefits. It is a kind of one of the backbones of our interconnected transit system, and the $2 billion of development already in place really shows that this project has already had strong economic value. So we're looking forward to finishing it. We think things are going well. The Secant pilings have already been completed next to the Seca building, and we understand from the field that they were continuing to track that resequencing schedule that we negotiated last year. So with that, I will, as they say, stand down and be available.
Thank you for your testimony. I believe there is one other gentleman who wanted to testify. Please make your way to the testifiers table. And while you're doing that, I will note that we do have a quorum. The quorum is present. Oh, and I will also note that Senator Port is present virtually from Burnsville, Minnesota. Welcome to the testifiers table. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chairperson, my name is Mark Hughes, and I guess this has been an interesting afternoon. I have concerns as a taxpayer that it's 38% over budget, the Southwest Light Rail. And then I heard in the OLA report the gentleman testifying or presenting saying that the Met Council is making decisions and spent and using other people's money. That may or may not be fair. It may have happened. It may not. But the same holds true. Okay, the cost went up 38%. Did anybody measure inflation? If there was a delay in the project, there's sometimes you can help it, and sometimes you can't. But I am concerned that we have a product that is 9 years over budget, or 9 years late, and way over budget, and as a taxpayer, I'd be concerned. First of all, you got to manage, and I'm concerned. I'm concerned about that in other facets of the Met Council. I think that we should take a deeper dive, and I'm really concerned, and I'm upset. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hughes.
You're welcome.
Members, discussion, questions? Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, it's frustrating, as Mr. Hughes just mentioned, there's many taxpayers in Minnesota that are upset with what's happened, the amount of over budget, some of the processes, the transparencies, and one that stood out to me when the discussion was going on was about an $83 million project or change order that was not competitively bid. That is something that I find hugely concerning. That is something, you know, I can't remember most projects, city projects, I think it's anything over a certain amount of $25,000 or $100,000 has to be competitively bid. And we have an $83 million project that was not competitively bid. I'm just curious, and I don't know who would answer that, but who was in charge of that? I mean, was it the Metropolitan Council themselves that made that decision not to have that competitively bid? Or where was that decision made?
It looks like Mr. Kirshner is making his way. Mr. Kirshner.
Well, it may be the case that the Metropolitan Council would like to speak to this as well, but I'll start since that was where part of my presentation. The way in which this was put together was the idea was that there was a competitive bidding process of many, many millions of dollars. I don't remember what the actual amount is. I'm going to say it's 900 and something million for the civil construction contract. And so that was competitively bid. But then there are often changes that happen to a project afterwards. You dig somewhere and, oh, the utilities aren't where you expect them to be. And so then we have to do some sort of change to the project specifications, and that might end up meaning that you end up paying the contractor a little more money because they have to dig somewhere else. So you have a process that is set up for changes to a project. And what the Metropolitan Council did was they used this project, this process of, you know, changes to a project, which is ordinarily for things that are not $83 million, and did that as, like, this is not a new, you know, it's not a separate standalone thing. It is, in fact, a change to an existing process. And so they went through their change process. But that change process involves a direct one-on-one negotiation between the Metropolitan Council and the contractor. There's not a competitive bid for that because it's viewed as a change to an already existing project. But we have the same concerns that you do, that when you're talking about something of that size, not having that, having been, we think the solution should have not been, you know, competitively bid it later, because it would be in many ways impractical to bring in a different company in the middle of the current construction contractor's work site and have them try and build something in the middle of all the stuff that the other contractor is doing. That would be very difficult. We think the solution would have been to have that in the project specifications in the first place so that it would be part of the competitive bid. And so then not only would they have gotten the best price for the construction as there, but it would also have meant that would have been part of the contractor's responsibility to schedule the work appropriately to include the building of that corridor protection barrier within all of the other stuff that it was doing, as opposed to what happened is that they had to add it in later, which meant they not only had to add in the cost of the construction of it, but there was all of the disruption related to building that when it wasn't as part of their initial plan for how they were going to build the project. And the thing is that the Metropolitan Council knew at the time that it was putting this out for a bid that it was going to add that later. It just was not able to put it in at that time, in part because the environmental review process for the wall itself was not completed yet. As I said, the Metropolitan Council has said that it would have cost even more to delay the bidding further. Our reaction to that is that we don't think it's knowable one way or the other. But at the end of the day, you do have this large piece of work that was not competitively bid, and we're as uncomfortable about that as you are, Senator Jasinski.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, sir, and thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I have a little bit of background in real estate and construction, and I know that change orders are usually the most expensive portion of a project. Just because of that, and to note to the size of an $83 million change order is really bad planning. Design, no matter what you call it, but again, I know change orders, that we're usually the contractor is like, well, this is what it's going to be. There's no checks and balances. They put the number out there, and pretty much they got the bull by the horns, because there's nothing that the person financing or building can do about it, because they have to have that. So that's really frustrating to see those kind of overruns because of bad planning. And I think that the number one slide that stuck out to me a little bit in your presentation, I can't remember which was Ms. Thiessen's or yours, the mismatch between entities that fund projects and entities that are responsible for constructing them. That is one of the biggest things that I see as an issue here, is you have someone spending someone else's money. And sometimes I wish we could apply that to the whole state funding, because that would be a concern as well of the who's spending the money and who's paying for it is a huge concern. It's frustrating, and I know in part of our budget we have, I think, $50 million in for a Blue Line extension, and I want to make sure that the lessons learned from this project will definitely carry forward to that, if that's funded, if that makes it through the finish line, because we can't have another one of these. And to my understanding, is this correct? We're still about $272 million short in funding to complete the project as is. Is that correct?
Mr. Kirshner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is my understanding. I will look to Metropolitan Council to see if they have found more money under the couch cushions since I last checked. They're nodding back at me. Yes, that is the current size of the gap. And I believe part of that has to do with there is some money that they are transferring over from a different federal program. They have not yet gotten the approval for that, which is why we put on our slide $2.384 million. But there's actually a little bit more federal money coming that they do expect to get the approval for, but has not come through yet. But they've been told that approval is coming, but they're not officially putting that into the project budget. But I believe that the amount you stated, $270 million, is about correct.
Okay.
Senator Jasinski.
And thank you, Mr. Then I'll just finish up and I can let other members talk. But I know a lot of people, I've heard comments about, well, it's mostly federal money. Well, that's federal money that could have been spent on other things in the state that could have been much better spent than what's happening with that money right now. So that's my frustration. I think it's everybody's frustration. I know it's been referred to as the biggest boondoggle in the state of Minnesota with how things were done, the money being spent, the lack of oversight, the non-transparency. So it is frustrating, and it's really frustrating to members of greater Minnesota to see that money being spent on something that it was so not well planned and planned for the construction side of it. So that's the frustration I hear. It's the frustration I have here. There's lots of money can be spent on transportation. I know there's some money that's coming from the motor vehicle sales tax that's going towards us. I believe if we follow the funding, there's some of it that could, some of the state share. Maybe I could be corrected on that. But again, there's most, I know Hennepin County and Met Council have come up, Hennepin County and the federal government are the ones that have funded most of it, but I think there's some other funding, and maybe you could correct me on the amount of state funding. And again, even if it's zero, the amount of federal money that could have been used better in the state of Minnesota is the frustration that I hear. So, Commissioner Zelli or Chair Zelli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Jasinski. I am not here necessarily to debate, but maybe to give a little bit more background for the committee to understand that particular corridor protection barrier process, because your frustration, and we share the frustration. But for learnings, that was intentionally kept out and was planned to be a change order. And in hindsight,
that $83 million sounds, and it is a big change. At the time, the AECOM, our design engineer, estimated the cost of that protection barrier to be roughly the $25 to $30 million. And at that time, there was an analysis of what is the best way, what's the most cost-effective way to bring that corridor protection barrier in place. The delay, because not just the environmental process, but getting City of Minneapolis, MnDOT, and then ultimately BNSF design approval added another year, year and a half to the process. So that year, year and a half added to considerably more, even more than that $83 million, but quite a bit more than the $25 to $30 million. So it really was done consciously to say in the best prudence that the having a change order on that element, given the estimated cost from our engineer design of record, thought that was the most prudent course. Now, in the process, BNSF had standards which were, I think, where they experienced in California for high-speed crash balls. It is highly engineered. It is, we think, no train would ever hurt any passenger light rail because it is a pretty robust system. But be as it is, it is what came in, and ultimately the change order was significantly more. We did go through, and I think Nick Thompson can speak to this, what due diligence in the process of that change order we had with outside cost estimators, independent engineers, and others to verify that that truly was the cost for that corridor protection element, which was required for the project.
Senator Jasinski.
And then, Madam Chair, just to follow up, so was the engineering company compensated based on the cost of the project?
Chair Zelli.
I would defer to Mr. Thompson, but I believe that the costs for that protection barrier were verified as actual costs. There wasn't an incentive for our contractor to inflate based upon that they were the ones, since they were on the job and on the site, it made sense to have a change order instead of competitively bid something in the middle of a construction zone.
Mr. Thompson, did you have something you wanted to add?
Maybe a clarification, Madam Chair. Did you ask about the engineering firm for the cost estimate? Could you clarify exactly?
Correct. So again, thank you, Madam Chair. So again, if you have an engineering firm that is being compensated based on the project costs, and those costs are done via change orders versus competitively bid, the engineering firm is going to benefit by higher costs. So the higher the project's going to cost, the more money the engineering firm is going to make. And that, again, is the reason I'm asking about an $83 million change order versus being competitively bid and included in the project, because obviously then it's to the advantage of the engineer to have it bid or not bid with a higher cost, and then they make more money. So that's a huge concern, and I want that addressed, because that's something that people are frustrated. I think, you know, Mr. Hughes was here. I think he left. But, I mean, those are things that we got to make sure what's going on, and not only for projects that are happening now but for future projects. That can't happen, because obviously there's no incentive for an engineering firm to bid it correctly and keep the cost down. If they're going to make more money by not bidding, and again, going back to the mismatch between the entities funding the projects and building them, there's no incentive to keep the cost down. That's the huge concern that I have, and I think a lot of people have voiced that. So can you just talk a little bit about that more? Because I think we need to talk about that.
Mr. Thompson.
Chair, Senator, there is no link that I could understand between we requested that the engineer design the wall. They have no, their compensation for the engineering is based on hours and time. It has nothing to do with the cost of the change order, which is with the construction contractor, which is independent from the design firm. We hired another engineering firm to do essentially a check on the cost estimate because of the discrepancy between what initial estimate from our engineer of record was and what the contractor said. So there is no tie for the size of the change order and the cost or the profit of the engineering firm. Those are not linked in this situation.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just you have a comment from the OLA on that comment, if we could, from the OLA.
Mr. Kirshner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Senator Jasinski. I think I'm going to have to say more to come on that. We're going to be talking about that a little bit in our next report.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator Lang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is probably a question for both Commissioners or Chair Zelli.
Well, I answered everything.
And the oil, yeah. Must have been, yeah, never mind. I'm not going to go down that road. There was a couple of different figures that were thrown out earlier that I'm just trying to confirm now. At one point, you said $2 billion had been spent so far, and I think that the gap that Jasinski was talking about just earlier was a little bit less than that. Can you speak to how much has actually been spent to this point?
Mr. Thompson, Chair Tully? Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senator, I don't know what the exact figure where we've spent so far. We're roughly 70% complete on the project, but the number we were speaking to earlier was what do we believe are the additional funds that need to be identified to finish the projected.
And what completion. Did you say that dollar figure was?
Mr. Thompson.
Chair and Senator, the report identified it as $272 million. We reflected it last year as a range because there's some unknowns. But, you know, that's in line with, you know, since the range we identified last year, we've identified and secured more funding. So $272 million identified in the report is, you know, a valid number based on the information we have now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So roughly, we're in that $2.4 billion spent at this point. What?
Chair Zelli?
Yeah, excuse me, Madam Chair, Sandra. There's additional work and funding available and contingencies available for the ongoing work that's going on now. So that isn't the full amount that's been already spent. It is the funds we have available, and we know that that will take us well through into this year. In fact, we have additional, and part of those funds are contingencies that we still have. So I don't know the extent of the exact amount we have already spent, but I do know we project ahead as to what the estimated costs are with what we know now. So we can come back to you with the exact figure of what we've spent so far, but it's well less than $2 billion.
Senator Lang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess the next question is then, with this project extending on so long and so far above what you initially planned on spending, what's your confidence level in this $2.77 billion total and being completed in 2027?
Madam Chair, Senator, I would say that there's always risk to these projects, and we've certainly seen that.
Yeah.
Although I have to say, since we've renegotiated with the contractor and now the systems contractor coming together and going through a mediation process for every change order, we're gaining confidence in that number. I think the riskiest part of the project is still the tunnel, and we're in still need to complete that work. So I would say we'd have a much better idea later this year, early next year, to give a much more confidence about eliminating most of the unknown factors.
What's the ongoing operational annual cost for the Southwest Light Rail? What's they projected to be?
Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, Senator, is your question around once the line is open?
Mm-hmm.
I believe our forecast in the report we provided to the legislature last fall, it was around $30 million to $35 million per year for the operating cost. That per statute, that is a local cost, 100% Hennepin County cost.
Senator Lang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the one final question I have before I make a comment on this is there a point when the Met Council is going to say, you know what, we've spent enough money, we're going to cut our losses, we're going to open up what we can open up and leave it at that? Or is this project, and you mentioned earlier, said you have full commitment to get the project done. So if this starts getting $4 billion, $5 billion, I mean, as I'm looking at this chart and watching the costs, and it's on a pretty steep climb, if it gets to that price range, is it not going to matter? Is it something where the Met Council is going to get it done come hell or high water? I mean, this is substantial. When we talk about moving people around the state of Minnesota, this is by far the most expensive way I think I've ever seen exhibited.
Well, Chair Zelli.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think that there's two many ways to look at it, but the most the dramatic increase during construction is hitting these issues associated with the Kenilworth Trail, no question. Though that is when the cost increases of the additional $500 million or so was ultimately negotiated, recognized, and forecasted. The previous periods when the scope changed during the planning process, it is, true costs of projects aren't known until you finish the design work, until you actually scope and understand what it is you're building. So I'm kind of focusing from the original contract period when the ground was broken in 2018 to where we are today. $2.7 billion, we believe, on a cost per mile basis is comparable and to other projects around the country. I think the $2 billion of development along the line already has shown that there's been economic benefits, and we still believe that this is a very viable and important project. Is there still risk in the project? Yeah, absolutely. But we think that that is being reduced every month. And in fact, now getting through that CECA corridor has been one element of risk that was important to get through. And there's not an issue of you can kind of open just one segment. I mean, it does hold together as one continuous extension. It's not one you can say, well, I'll only go to Hopkins or, and if you kind of drive around and see so much of this work is complete, a lot of the civil work is complete, and now it's the systems work, the electrical wires, the below and above ground wiring, and then operations coming in a few years. So we don't foresee it going into that kind of levels of increases. I think we've experienced the biggest jump.
Senator Lang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm glad, Commissioner, you brought up comparables, because this is the Transportation Committee, and we tend to build roads, bridges, fun things like buses. You know, that's, we've had a whole day. We talked about electric buses and diesel fuel buses, hybrid buses, and comparables. This is something where I think the public needs to, you know, we need to talk about what the comparable really is. And, you know, I know what a lane mile of highway in Minnesota costs. Costs about $1 million per lane mile. It's about 45 miles around the 694 loop. If you took half that $3 billion that you're going to spend and you put lanes on 494, 694, that's about 15 lanes. Additional. That's more than we have now. If you took the other half and threw it at buses, it cost, you know, I think the electric ones are about 300,000, give or take, when we sat in the committee here. That's 5,000 buses. 5,000 buses that carry 60 people apiece. I think we're misguiding our resources here on such a vast level where, and then the other thing is buses aren't stuck on the same old rail. They can change their routes. They can go wherever the people live. And it's just really frustrating to see this much money being spent for, after watching the blue lines and the green lines really struggle to get ridership on them. I know that we're committed to this project at this point. I just hope to God that there's some semblance of normalcy when it comes to an end here, and hopefully we start putting some money into some transit projects that really are getting people where they need to be. So.
Well, and the
Chair
Madam
Zelli.
Chair, Senator, you're speaking to a genetic bus guy, so I don't disagree with you. I think they do provide tremendous value, but I think it's important to kind of look at a lot of different metrics when you look at transportation modes. And the fact is, there's a number of different modes, even within transit, and certainly our road system is part of that too. If we were to build the 694, 484 system without owning any of the right-of-way, that would be a very different cost number. So it's kind of hard to look at the comparables. But it is a fair point when you look at the also the life cycle of a rail, which lasts 50, 60, 70 years versus 10 years, which is the average cost of a bus. So it is kind of interesting to look at what the cost is per passenger. Certainly, we have issues with the North Star, where there's a tremendous cost per passenger, and it's not one anybody's feeling good about. That's important as we go into how we manage to interconnect a system that as a whole provides the value rather than looking at any just one line versus another, and it takes different modes to make that system work well.
Thank you. Members, other questions? Members, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony to all of you, and with no further business before us, we are adjourned.